If you're a physician who wants more autonomy in how you practice or fulfillment in your life, you're in the right place. This is the Change Physician Podcast, where our guests reveal how you can learn the mindsets, skills, and strategies to create the life you want without selling out your morals or values. But before we begin, I want to remind you of the free book giveaways, guides, and other physician resources available to you at thechangephysician.com. And it says we are live.
It does.
Well, welcome. I am Melissa Cady, joined by my co-host, Dr. Kevin Caccaro, and we are on the Change Physician Facebook page for the podcast and community. However, I've cross-posted to my own personal Challenge Doctor page, so if you're catching us there, we are actually initially live through the Change Physician. If you are a physician or you consider yourself a physician ally, feel free to join the community at thechangephysician.com. And we also are on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, definitely a little more busy on Instagram and Facebook, but we would love to have you join the community and be part of a lot of our discussions and stories and insights into many types of topics. And I'm sure on today's episode, which is our Christmas Eve special, we have a few things we'll chat about that might be a few tangents off of each other, but that's our typical way. So thank you for joining us today. Kevin, anything you want to start off with? Or maybe since we didn't do our Friday faves last week, mainly because of my crazy schedule, we could tap into what we missed on the Friday faves as far as our episodes.
Yes, we got to talk about what was published. So what was published at the end of last week was Dr. Erin Weissman, the fabulous Dr. Weissman. I wish there was a way we can tag her. If we were more savvy and we knew what we were doing, we'd figure out how to tag these people so they know we're talking about them and they're not like, oh, I heard you were, you know, ears burning in the background or something. But Erin Weissman, who is awesome, she is out on the East Coast. She does some coaching and she has some great stories about her kind of experiences going through residency and early practice and having a family and how she restructured her life and took control of that, which was awesome. And then we brought her back to do a second episode because Erin has her own podcast as well, which I think is Truth RX's. I'm not sure how you pronounce that exactly. Truth Prescriptions or whatever, where she does the one word episode. She has their guests and she asks them to talk about, you know, bring in a word and then they talk about the word. And I thought it was such an awesome idea. I was like, okay, we have to pull that. We're going to steal that from her. So we brought her back to talk about her one word, which was change. That was another great episode. Actually, we went all over the place with that episode because we talked about change and residency and different perspectives. And it was a reminder for me to be more aware of our own personal perspectives and how those are different from anybody else. And specific for that was, it was you and Erin and some of our perspectives on some of the medical issues, not necessarily medical issues, but the practice experiences that we have. We're more likely influenced also by our perspectives as either a male or female physician. I know that can rile people up at everything, but if you're not recognizing that you have inherent biases based upon either your sex, your race, background, social strata and things, then you're not recognizing what the literature shows because that's pretty evident there. And that was a good reminder for me. I really enjoyed that. Then we also had Dr. Marcy Larson, another great guest who came on to talk about grieving. She had done an episode back. Her first episode was published in November. So on November 22nd, where she talked about why she started her podcast, which came really through a pretty tragic event when she lost her son in a horrible accident. But how she began this podcast and has really found how helping others and helping herself with learn about grief through her guests, who are all people who have had most of them who've lost a child, what she's learned from that. And she came back onto our podcast to help us to understand that process. That was a fantastic one. I got to tell you, if you haven't seen it, grief is something we will always deal with as physicians. We're in a very, I'm going to use the word privileged. I'm not sure if that's the right word to use, but it's kind of inherent in who we are and what we do and the people that we deal with. And that I think is an episode that everybody should be watching, and particularly physicians, because we will encounter grief and how best we can support our patients through that process in a way that is helpful and not necessarily, you know, we're not walling ourselves off, but we're not overwhelming them perhaps with our own behaviors. I certainly found it useful on my in personal life, and we've had some really close friends that had some personal losses and things. So I'm really glad that we had that episode there. So that was great. And then obviously we have today's episode, and then we have a couple episodes for next week where we're going. We have the fabulous Dr. Tate will be back on the show. He'll be published on Sunday when we'll be talking about capital and what that means. It's not capital cities and the capital of this country, but actually capital in a business sense. And then to continue this trend, we will have Out with the Old, In with the New, and that'll be the New Year's Eve special from the Change Physician. So we'll be doing this again live next week for New Year's Eve. So it is a packed schedule in a pretty exciting time and some cool stuff that we're doing to close out 2020.
Yeah. And so since you were talking about our savviness, I was trying to be a little bit more on top of the live action on our Facebook Live. So as you're talking about people, I've tagged them into the thread. And then I found their website that you just kind of like revealed a few things that, they're involved in. So they are in the chat. So you can find and click on those links and go straight there. And hopefully they'll see that we just talked to them or about them in this episode. So, usually on Friday Faves, we talk about our favorite thing of the week. And I thought I'd just pop in a picture of something that I'd never done before and thought would be kind of fun. Are you cool with that?
I am totally cool with that.
Okay. So I'm going to have to do a little share here with the share the screen. And let's see here. All right. You see these things?
Whoa.
I know they're not, they're not the perfect pretty, but they are functionally, they are working well. But you know how you get that? I love these white chocolate covered pretzels that have the peppermint on them, and they had a ton of pretzels at the bottom of the bag, little pieces of it. Mm-hmm, it's like, mm-hmm. I can't just throw this away, but I don't want to eat it straight. So I bought a sugar cookie mix, okay, of all places, at Tractor Supply, because I had to get some like things there. I'm like, okay, I'm buying cookie mix at a Tractor Supply store. But anyway, I'll give it a try because I didn't want to have to go deal with more people in another place. You can actually see a little bit of pieces of pretzel and some of that peppermint candy. Anyway, so I made the sugar cookies and I decided at the last few minutes to just drizzle a whole bunch of those little pieces. So those are my peppermint sugar cookies that apparently Corey, my husband, said that those are like the best cookies I've ever made. Peppermint
pretzel sugar cookies.
Yeah.
A new holiday tradition.
Peppermint. Now really the pretzel good. Part's not the essential part. It's the peppermint. So
but is there pretzel in there too?
No, it's just a tiny bit that was stuck to some of the peppermint because they came from the pretzels in the bag, but those are just like the little leftover peppermints that fell off the pretzels. So there you go. If you ever have any extra peppermint at the bottom of your bag, buy some sugar cookie mix.
Well, I think adding a little pretzel in there sounds really good though, because then it has a little bit of crunch, you know, and it also rolls off the tongue. Peppermint pretzel sugar cookies, although you have to add something on the end of that, but.
Yeah, you have to say that.
You need really to brand bad. It, Melissa, is what you need to do. You have to have special branding on that. And
I don't know if I have the desire to push for that or not. I mean, I'm sure people have made these before. Although I looked up for a recipe like that, and actually I was looking for a peppermint, like it'd be cool to throw it in a bread, like some kind of sweet bread, and like throw in, not just on the top, but maybe throw in some peppermint into, I don't know, it just seems kind of yummy. My mouth's watering as I talk
about
it.
Are you a pepperminter?
I'm not really. But you know what I realized? This season is not the time to try to find a bag of crushed peppermint because it's sold out everywhere because everyone's baking at this time. And I guess there's a lot of people using peppermint. So I bought a whole bunch of candy canes because my husband will like to have some more of these cookies for the weekend. So I'm just going to crush them with a hammer.
And that's what you should see if the difference, if there's a difference with just plain peppermint actually versus the peppermint pretzel. I would be shocked. I think in that maybe the peppermint pretzel might actually be a better combination, but
yeah, but it was very good. So that was one of my favorite, adventures. Cause you just get these random thoughts and ideas and you think, okay, well, how well is that going to turn out? So you don't know until you try. So there you go.
You don't. Yeah. It's
like being an entrepreneur or starting a podcast or just trying.
Do and then direct, not try to anticipate everything.
So did you have anything that was put you on the spot? Anything favorite over the past week?
It has been an interesting week. I was sort of trying to formulate a plan for 2021. So that has been interesting. Some sort of goal setting exercises and trying to develop some habits. I've had some problems with consistency and really planning. So what I've been doing is I actually have this little book and I'm now like planning days, and it's, you can tell it's not like a journal. It's a reminder. Right? What I'm trying to do with that is write stuff down and check into it and really choose the two or three important things that need to get done every day and do those. Mm-hmm. I have some books. I wasn't sure whether I should do this week or next week, but some of like my favorite things, and I've mentioned this before. So this one, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. I've mentioned that on at least two.
Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Two. This is her most recent book. I loved How Emotions Are Made. I thought that was, absolutely mind-blowing and change your nature with everything. And that this book, I will probably become one of my gifted books. So if you are a friend or family member and you're wondering what will I get you in the future, it will probably be this book. And I don't really care if you're not interested, because you should know each of these lessons is super relevant to being a human. And I think I mentioned before, it's delicious. Like I literally would read a chapter a day and I would stop and just process it, and it was great. And then the other one, which is really good, was, I mentioned this one too. This was Good Habits, Bad Habits by Wendy Wood. And Wendy Wood is a psychologist. I think she's at USC. And as compared, there's a lot of books on habits out there. The vast majority of them have not been written by scientists doing the research. And that's okay. But I kind of prefer, if I'm going to read those, I want to know also the science. And what I really like about this one is she goes into science and she talks about the research behind the stuff, and there's implications there. And what I found is the more you know the background, like the what and the why of something rather than just the how to, you can start using that. Like you have that context now, you can start thinking of ways to apply it in new and different ways. So I've been really enjoying this book. Yeah. So those are my favorite things for the week. And I guess the last thing would have to be, we need to talk about Christmas Eve, because I'm really curious about this and I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
Is what kind of, what were your, because 2020 is crazy. So yeah. What were your Christmas traditions, or did you have a special tradition? I guess we could lead with, was Christmas Eve and like the key holiday in your family or not? Was there something else?
Yes. Christmas and Thanksgiving are very big gatherings and lots of food, more food than any human being needs. That is definitely a very social thing for my upbringing. And interestingly, this year, as much as my parents would have loved for me to be there Thanksgiving and Christmas from a health standpoint, I didn't think it was wise. So, and especially the kind of work I do. So I'm placing breathing tubes in people on a near daily basis. So I have potential exposure. I try to be careful, but I just let them know about a week ago that, you know, as much as you were hoping Christmas would be the one, I think we'll need to push this off for at least a couple more months and see where we're at. So the reason I say that is that despite the social aspect, there's a component of our traditions that my mother is insistent on to happen over Zoom. So one of those traditions is Christmas Eve is when we do the gift opening, and she requires us to guess three times before we open the gift. So we have to see if we can predict what the gift is. And of course, if we're in person, we get to like hold it, feel it, shake it, whatever you want to do. Well, they've got the gifts in their possession, so this is going to be the most unique Christmas ever, because they're going to have us guess, and on their side, they're going to open it for us and then show it to us on video.
That will be interesting.
Yes. So can't say that's super exciting for anyone to really know about me, but it is kind of a tradition that has been in our family for a long time. So,
and you're continuing it, which is the exciting part, right?
Yeah,
you're adapting it to the Zoom age.
Yeah, I would say that the guessing part is kind of like, it's just a like it's just a tradition. It's not kind of like, you know, I don't know. Sometimes we guess it right, sometimes you don't, but you, it's like, it's a passage to opening. You can't open until you like guess three times, even if they're terrible guesses.
Well, you know, what I like about that, and particularly if you had young kids, right? Mm. Like, it slows you down.
Yes.
So I'd be really curious, you know, talk to your mom, like, how did that develop? Because I could see, you know, kids just start ripping into everything, and as a parent, it's always a pain. Like, my kids are old now, so but I just remember, because you're like, slow down, we got to write it down so you can make sure the thank yous and blah, blah, blah. But I love that guessing, because if you have young children, what that would do is it slows it down and it keeps it fun, and it's not a torturous thing, you know? Yeah. Like, that seems like a fun thing to do when you're 5 years old and you're like trying to guess or whatever, and then you'd be watching. I think that sounds, what a great idea. Now I wish I had young kids so I could do it to them.
You try it on them. Yeah, it's a little bit of an anticipatory thing that creates some, try to build in some patience, most definitely. So yeah. What about you?
Well, my family is very interesting. We had, when I was growing up, Christmas and Christmas Eve were without a doubt the most important holidays of the years in my family. We had a very well-established routine where we go to my grandparents' house for Christmas Eve. And that was always fun. We had, you know, there's huge families. Ours wasn't a big family, but it was large, you know, three grandparents, three kids. Of those kids, then we had five grandkids. And then as the great grand started pulling in, it started getting bigger and bigger. And there was always other family cousins and stuff that would come in. And it was always a super special time of the year. My grandmother was a fabulous self-taught pianist. Mm. Who you could hum a tune to and she could play it, like literally like that. Like, she, all she needed is a couple bars and she would start to play it. And so we sang every Christmas Eve. My favorite part was when we would get done with the Christmas carols and we would go into old songs. Like, I'm a fourth generation native Nevada, and I'm quite proud of that, even though haven't lived there for 20 years. And so we'd sing all these old songs, like the songs that my grandparents would do in the old, like, cause they lived in rural Nevada and did all the stuff, and the songs that they would sing with their friends, right? In the old days before social media, you would get together, there would be a piano, my grandma would play, there'd be dancing and things. And I just always loved that. And then on the Christmas day, we'd go to my uncle's house and we did that every year. In fact, there was a year we had this huge snowstorm and my mom is like, well, it looks like we're not going to make it to grandpa and grandma's. And I'm like dying. I'm like, this is going to work. This is going to work. She's saying we're going to go to Pizza Hut. I'm like, this is going to suck. She's probably, maybe, I don't know. As a parent now, I can see how it would be excited. And I'm about ready to just die and lose it. And all of a sudden there's a knock on the door. It's my grandpa and my uncle had driven in their four-wheel drive truck to pick us up through this blizzard.
Oh my God.
And then to take us to my grandparents' house, because they lived in a more rural area in this valley, Washoe Valley in Nevada. So that was, it was always great. Tried to preserve that through medical school, did a pretty good job. I don't think I missed we didn't miss a Christmas until my son was born. Mm-hmm. And then that first year we were both, we were in the middle of our internship. It was either middle internship or my first year in anesthesia. So we couldn't get the call schedules right. And we had a 9-month-old baby. And so we didn't. So we missed that one. And then it became more periodic. We missed a couple. And then when my grandparents passed in 2006, that really kind of changed everything. So we have now had a family. We've had, what's been kind of interesting for us now is the tradition for the non-traditional tradition for us for Christmas is completely unpredictable. We went skiing one year, like we drove up to the slopes and just went skiing. Another year we had my wife's cousin and his family over and we made pot stickers. And so it's smaller, different, a little bit more intimacy, but definitely my memories of Christmas past were of large families and singing. And yeah. And if you have a large family that sings, make sure someone can play the piano. That's like, we never had anybody after my grandpa's. There was nobody who could play the piano like her. So that really curtailed our singing experience. And I do miss that quite a bit.
Yeah. You reminded me, my grandmother, my dad's mother, she passed not too long back, but she was one of those that literally a few bars, she could just play things without, you know, never have played it before. It just has the sounds and the connection. It's amazing. When you talk about the brain from that book you're talking about, like just the different complexities and connections that occur, that are not even things you think of in words. It's just this kind of intuition of knowing which key to hit for that sound.
It's amazing.
It's incredible.
It is. Yeah. And the other frustrating thing about that is they don't teach that. Like, I'm sure the way that your grandmother taught and the way my grandmother taught, or not taught, but played. So I took piano when I was younger, only did a couple of years and I dropped out. And sorry, Mom, I know that was a big disappointment to you. But no one teaches like that chord play and stuff.
Yeah.
And so even when my kids were taking piano, I even mentioned to their teacher, I'm like, I wish you would kind of pull this in. I don't know if anybody, it's different, right? And maybe, and I know from like the experts, like the formally classically trained, they poo-poo on chord play and all this stuff. But I think if you're not going to go and become a classical pianist, it would be way more valuable for people who are learning piano to learn chord play, because that's the fun play. Like, that is where you can get together with friends and family and do that stuff. No one's going to sit down and, I mean, very few people are going to sit in some grand concert hall and play adagio for blah, 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 and it has to be perfect. But a lot of people would sit down and sing with their friends, I think, if you could actually play that way. And it's so hard to find teachers that do that. Like, I still can't find any, but I haven't been looking. Anyway, that's
interesting. Yeah. My parents have an upright piano that came from one of the grandparents, and I have a little organ that I can play by ear a little bit. I never really had any piano lessons, but I played clarinet, so I kind of transferred being able to read the music and learned a couple of songs, like what is it, Feralise, and I could play segments of that and smoothly and easily on certain segments. But it's just from like memory, and it easily goes that way. But when it comes to reading again, like, I haven't read music in a while, so I can tell that the spaces are F-A-C-E. Like, I remember some of those basics, but they do show on this book for this organ. It's like one of those like portable kind of organs that my dad gave me. Anyway, there's chords. They teach you the chords in the book, but it's not someone teaching me. But I keep thinking, imagining myself doing more of that later as I get older. So it's interesting you said that, because I would like to be able to do that.
Well, you can start now.
Yeah, but I can't say I'm the best singer. I'm better at dancing or playing an instrument. This instrument, the vocal cords, has not been trained.
if you learn the organ, then you could, that's what you can pull in the singers for it or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I would call it more of a keyboard, one of those portable keyboards, and it has a collapsible little thing underneath it, but it just helps you raise it. But anyway, yeah. Did you play an instrument?
So I took 2 years of piano and quit and broke my mother's heart. And I took 2 years of trumpet.
Oh, really?
I did do 2 years of trumpet. Kind of puddled around with some other stuff or whatever. That's sort of been kind of a regret, is I like music a lot, and kind of easy to me, which is probably one of the problems. I didn't practice hard enough. And I think about that. I always hate to say this, like, because you're like, oh, I would like to go back to it. And then the first question should be, well, why aren't you doing it? Right. That's why I brought that up. Because if it's really important to you, you will do it.
Right.
And so it must not be important to me enough yet that I'm willing to do something about it. But maybe in the future I could see that.
Interesting.
Yeah. I kind of frame those things a little bit differently. And I am lucky, because my kids both played, and my daughter quit. It was weird. My daughter was really good at practicing, like super, super good. And then when she decided she couldn't put the practice time in because their school was getting busier. So she quit, and she's never touched the piano again. My son, who wasn't as diligent about practicing when he was in lessons, he continued after she quit for about a year. And then he's like, I can't, I need to stop or whatever. And he stopped it. He plays more now than he played with his lessons. And that's really kind of cool. So you'll just sit and all of a sudden you hear music coming from the basement. It's because that's his break now. He goes down there and he plays. And So I still love music. I think at some point it'll come back in. I really would love to learn how to, if I could find someone who played by chord, like who can teach me chords, I would do that, but I don't want to take lessons just to learn the, you know, the standard stuff. I want to learn chord play, improvisation, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if someone comments and says, you got to learn the basics first, ah, come on. My grandma learned this stuff on her own. So she figured it out. I think you can start with the chords, but anyway.
Yeah. No, I think you bring up a really interesting point, because I think there's a lot of decisions or things in life that, you know, whether it is choosing to play the piano, or you basically this comment you said that if it's important enough to you, you'll do it. And I think that plays in really well to making changes in your life, to be a changed physician, to whether even decisions, you know, especially female physicians like myself, who somehow get so fixated and focused on their career and don't make having children a priority, where I'm at an age where it's kind of like, okay, you're kind of late to the game. You know, was it not important enough to me through all these years? What is more important to you? And it really dictates kind of the path that you're going on. And I think it's, I kind of wonder if that really is a good way to, I mean, I think it's a good way to look at it, because whatever, if you want to lose weight, you know, if it, it's almost like there's sometimes people that they have to either get angry enough, scared enough, or fed up enough to make a change. And it's at that point where now it is important to you, because it took that to be important enough. Any comments?
Well, yeah, there's two on that. Tony Robbins has a saying, which I always kind of liked, when it was dissatisfaction ends in action. And he kind of saw it as if rather than get frustrated by dissatisfaction, get excited by it, right? Because that's dissatisfaction is fuel for change. That being said, it would be easy to take what I said in the wrong way. Like, if it's important enough, you'll change. Because I'm going to say, well, you know, this is important to me and something didn't change. I think with that, we have to add in that theme that we have talked about many, many, many times, is if it's important to enough and you have of awareness enough, then you can change. Because in when you're in that busy, the busy role, when there's so many external stressors, your priorities will fall to the bottom unless A, you're aware enough that they need to be a priority for you, right? Mm-hmm. So that awareness piece comes into that, building a level of awareness on what is and what isn't important to you, what your values are, what they aren't, the behaviors that you would tolerate, what you want. That I think is an action that we should all learn a little bit more when we're younger and continue to practice that. Because then I think it's true. Then you will, if it is important enough, you can make change. But if you're not aware, it's easy for all that stuff to come by. And then you have regret, right? Then you have 20 years down there, like you're regretting all this stuff. Well, the regretting of the stuff is because you kind of got parried by life rather than, you know, working through life.
So those are all great points. And you're making me think, well, what do you think about the way you're raised? What is focused on as a family, or how, whatever your upbringing is and whatever is prioritized or valued in your family, and how that sometimes, if there's not discussion or understanding or awareness within the family of those values, how they get embedded within the core of who you are, you just assume this is how a lot of other people are. And then you live your life or go become a physician, not realizing, have an awareness of where that came from. Any thoughts?
Yes. Yes. No, I think that's the tricky thing, right?
Because
then how do you develop awareness? That's metacognition. How do you think about thinking? How are you aware of why you make the decisions that you make rather than just making the decisions you make? How does that occur? I'm not exactly sure. What, you know, oftentimes it may be there was a triggering agent as well, but certainly we were influenced by our childhoods, and we were in a lot of ways, as a parent, I think about that quite often. Like, well, what am I teaching my kids through my words, my deeds, my actions, and things like that? I use other examples of parents. In my, you know, there's things that I think I could have learned that I wasn't taught as a kid that I wish I had known now. I think that will always be something as an adult that you will wish you had learned as a child that you didn't know, right? I just think that's the nature of the beast, but to increase that level of, you know, that just, once you learn the concept of awareness, I think that's the other thing is to just keep focusing on it And maybe the first thing to is to be curious, right? I guess that's, you know, where, because this becomes like this pitfall. Like you keep going back and going back as well. What if you didn't learn curiosity? What if you were learning this driven family? What's going to be the triggering event that's going to trigger this change in perspective? And maybe that's going to come back to that dissatisfaction comment. You know, maybe up until someone has been dictating, you're going to be a doctor, or this is the career path. And I said I was going to be a doctor at the age of 5, and I'm going to follow this whole thing. And then you get into practice, and then your other people are telling you how you're practicing and how your life is supposed to be. And you have to buy the house and have the 2.3 kids, and you need your dog. And then you need to work in for 30 years, saving for retirement so that you can then do the things that you want to do. Maybe that's the point of dissatisfaction. You know, when you are dissatisfied, instead of just being upset by that, is taking a moment and saying, why am I dissatisfied? And explore that a little bit more. And then maybe that will help to kind of bring a level of awareness to things that we want to change. But that's a good point. Cause if you're not aware, you can't change. Yeah. It's just not going to happen.
Cause I think back, and of course, our best reference is our own lives. So it's easier for me to kind of reflect on my own, but I would say essentially an eternal optimist. I would consider myself, I'm practical and I think I'm a pragmatic person, but I like to be optimistic. I think when I look back at myself, I don't think I had any awareness to realize that, you know, of what was driving me. Like, I just knew I was driven, and it was valued, because it tied into career and making something in your life and whatnot. There was no priority in, or discussion about social connection and relationships or having children or family. You know, family was important. Half of my family is like Hispanic, and it's kind of a traditional value. But I think when I look back, that I don't think even, and I remember a couple moments of people trying to create an awareness within me, but it was very, I didn't want to hear it. Like, I just shut it. It just wouldn't go in, because I had to maintain my own sense of this world I was trying to make sense of, and that cognitive dissonance was so strong, I didn't even recognize it for what it was. It was just kind of like more annoyed at the people trying to, like, maybe create change.
How old were you when that was happening?
20s.
Oh, okay. 20s. Okay. I was expecting teenage years or something.
Oh, no. I'm thinking like early 20s.
Because, you know, in our teenage years, we don't want to, we're smarter. We know everything. The parents are dumb, kind of a deal. And so any sort of advice at that time stimulates that reactance of, you're threatening my autonomy, kind of deal. I get early 20, I could see that as well. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing. But I also don't like when people say, well, people only change when they want to change. Well, that is in some ways true, but there is that. I just also think that's probably where the persuasion comes in. If we know someone's self-destructive or doing something, we wouldn't want to say, well, because this actually isn't true. It's common belief people have to hit rock bottom before they can change, and they can change before that. It's just, it's harder work, and for the other individual involved with facilitating change, it's much harder for them, and they must have much more investment in it. But yeah, it's interesting. All the, how we change, how we develop, how we learn, how we grow, when we learn what, it's fascinating. It's definitely fascinating. Yeah.
You know, it also makes me think, and I know that I think there's a lot of people like this where emotionally I was not, I wouldn't have considered myself an emotionally intelligent person. I think I've gotten better, but it's definitely, if you're going to try to help somebody, you know, I'm curious your thoughts on this. But in my life, in my 20s, I would have needed somebody to truly show unconditional love for me and really connect, despite maybe my kind of, I wouldn't call it coldness, but just kind of a very matter-of-fact kind of approach to things. And for me, if I felt that person really cared and was connected, and they asked me the right questions, because the way my mind works, I think that I would feel safe, where it might open up the awareness. I think that was the only chance, but I didn't really have that kind of connection with the person that could ask me the right questions.
No, I think that's a fair assessment, you know, and that safety is definitely true, right? We have to feel safe if we're under threat, or we feel the, you know, it rather, you know, what's the difference between a question and an interrogation? Right. You know, it's because so often, you know, I could just, as a parent, you're like, I'm just asking questions, but your kid's probably perceiving that as an interrogation. And that's a huge threat involved with that.
Yeah.
You know, I do think from a peer standpoint, having people in your life that demonstrate the actions that, you know, if you're demonstrating the action and you're living your life, I do think that has an impact. I think of some of the people that probably have changed me the most through some of the experience I've had was just through watching them, like, wow, why are they doing that? Or this is what they're doing. And it's a safe way, you know, observing someone doing something that is, I don't know, say is respectable, but is that provides you a different way of thinking, a little bit different. I think that's probably a safe way. And it's probably a good way if you are dealing with somebody new and you're like, oh, they're either self-destructive or I would like to help them with this, is to make sure you're demonstrating that rather than telling or interrogating them.
Right, right.
Because that'll switch someone off so fast, like nothing. Interesting stuff. Yeah. It is interesting. Like here's the other thing. I am not the same person I was 10 years ago. I'm certainly not the person I was 20 years ago. I was reading something when it talks about memory. Like we also have this idea that memory is like this photo in your brain, and it's not at all.
Yeah.
The best explanations is your memories are themes that then your brain reconstructs the images of, which is really important on many terms, which also means is A, your memories are malleable. Two, you can start readjusting your memories into a more empowering mindset and way. So you can start pulling out the positive rather than living in the traumas and things. But with that memory aspect, one of the parts about that in your conscious mind now is the way that we connect in many ways are on our past memories. Like, so your oldest friends that you've known since you were five or whatever, what you have is a shared history that combines. And so there are some theories that when you have not seen someone for a long period of time and you meet and reconnect, the first thing you're doing is what was your past? Because you're trying to fill in those gaps to reconnect with their new you. Because every person that you are not you, you know, you tomorrow is not the same you today. You 10 years now is not the same you that you are right now. And if you have somebody that's important enough to you and you meet them again, you need to fill in those memory gaps in such a way that them is the new you and you as the new you are now new friends based upon filling on those gaps. So that's a long way to say is I am not the same person I was when I was in high school. I'm certainly not the person I was in elementary school. I'm not the person I'm 10 years ago. I like who I am. Probably more than the person I was in high school. I don't think I was a bad person in high school. But yeah, it's you're not fixed. We're always in this constant process of change. And I think it's okay. That's a good thing to be aware of, that we are creatures of change.
So in the last 10 years, what do you think is the biggest shift for you? What was the biggest change?
Mindset, without a doubt. Like, so you're talking about like things that you learned as whatever, you were driven, you didn't know why or whatever. I was a total fixed mind. And we've talked about mindset before, fixed versus growth mindset. I was so fixed mindset. I very early on, I had experiences that said that I had this idea that I was smart. And because of that, I was kind of did the smart things. If you know anything about fixed mindset, it also means I didn't challenge myself as much as I could, because if I failed, then it would reflect that really bad personally on myself. I procrastinated a lot because that was an excuse. If you're a procrastinate, you study the night before and you do one on a test, it's like, well, I'm smart. If you study the night before on a test and you do bad, well, I could have done better if I just studied more, blah, blah. It doesn't really mean I'm not smart anymore. So that was a huge, huge, huge thing for me. And just recognizing the capacity for growth. I wish I had learned that again 20, 30 years ago, because I will default to that fixed mindset quite often, but at least I'm aware enough now But that certainly has changed pretty much everything. Like pretty much everything for me is just knowing that I can change has provided. I just can't, you can't even put a price on that. It is so valuable. I should write Carol Dweck a letter and just say, you've changed my life. You're the most amazing person.
You should. I love that.
Yeah.
That's always nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, it's the Change Physician podcast and community, and that change is, you know, reflected in our own personal lives. And you talked about how you've changed, and, we talked about even music. And I know there's something recently that might be music to people's ears, is that the vaccine has come out for COVID in this world and crazy year of change. You know, I know that Pfizer, BioNTech, who merged together to work on this, had released on the forefront, and then Moderna's right after. Any thoughts? What are you thinking about from a vaccine standpoint, where you stand with that?
I would totally get it. I'm not in the front of the line in any way, shape, or form. My wife actually got her first dose. Thursday. She got it 2 days ago. So she got on the 22nd.
Moderna or Pfizer? I'm assuming Pfizer. Pfizer.
She got the Pfizer. Yeah. I think it's a game changer. I think, you know, from a physician standpoint, I think one of the most disturbing things is, I don't know what the best way to distribute the vaccine would be. But I do know that there are a lot of private practice physicians who are definitely frontline that are struggling to get the vaccine because it was distributed to hospitals. And I do think, there's some good hospital systems, and then there's not some good hospital systems. And I wish, I don't know, I'm not sure what the right way is. Because the other thing is, if you saw the Stanford blow up and the residents were like fourth tier for getting the vaccine, and it's despite the fact that a lot of residents are being really pushed to be in, you know, pushed into the harm's way in a lot of scenarios.
Yeah.
So I wish the distribution was a little bit better, but once I can get it, I will definitely get it. Like there's no ifs, ands, or buts. What about you?
Yeah. So, you know, let me just make a few comments. You know, whether people hear this or not, I think it's important for me to say, I have some friends that, have heard me kind of be, I'm not anti-vax, and I'm basically I like to be commonsensical about things and just like read about it and try to understand the pros and cons and the risks and the efficacy. And when you look at some of the big ones that are like measles and the other vaccines that have like a 90%+ effectiveness, and you can split hairs and try to explain all the definitions of what these things mean. But the point is that to me, I've always been a little hesitant on some of the flu vaccines out there that are seasonal, because they seem to be quite variable in their effectiveness. And when we talk about herd immunity and try to capture the majority of the population so that we don't have these increased transmission rates and whatnot, it's hard for me to like wrap my head around something that might be 30% effective, and how, even if you got it to everyone, how really effective it would be for that. But when it comes to COVID-19 and this vaccine, the approximately 95%, you know, efficacy of it is something that is worthwhile to me. So I'm interested. I think some of the stories behind how Pfizer, BioNTech, I watched, I think, the 60 Minutes documentary on that, and read a little bit about Moderna, and just, you know, how these things have come to what they've been within a year, like literally within a year. I think that's pretty phenomenal. But the technology itself and the mRNA, and how a small genetic piece of material from the little studs that you see on the COVID pictures, you know, if you're listening and you don't know DNA and RNA and how things, you know, are made, you can go look that up. But the fact that they can replicate in a little vector and be able to replicate the small piece of genetic material. I know there's some questions as to, you know, you could have debates about where this vector comes from. And the way I see it is, and I'll just say this, I have had a friend of mine send me something that a fetus, you know, that it was one of the generations from the mid 1950s, and it, you know, that how can you kill a fetus? I'm like, okay, They're not killing fetuses just for this vaccine. If there's an elective abortion, there's a little bit of genetic material from years ago, and I'm not the expert. Go find someone who's an expert on vaccines. But I will say that this small contribution to the world to help deal with this pandemic, that is a very, it's an amazing contribution for an amazing advance that is giving people the opportunity to have the immunity to fight off this potentially lethal virus. And, I bring that up because I know we talk a lot about perspective and awareness and how you're interpreting the situation as to the sacrifice of a little bit of genetic material from eons ago to help create the technology to replicate the mRNA. To me, I see it in a very optimistic way. Like, this is a very positive thing for humanity. So I felt like saying all that. I know I'm on a diatribe there, but I feel like you can sit there and swing either way and be polarized about the situation. But this vaccine has been, I think, it's been an amazing team effort to create this. And so I am planning on getting mine next week. I was hesitant about getting it at first because I wanted a little more time to just see what's going on, read a little bit more, understand a little bit more. And it's going to be the Moderna, most likely. I'll update you on our next time together, but probably next Wednesday or Thursday. And so any physician, so I work in a surgery center. I'm not affiliated with the hospital. And I think this is really important. You might want to call a local pharmacy, because I caught wind that there's some pharmacies receiving some Moderna vaccine on Monday, at least locally here in Austin, Texas. And I talked to the pharmacist directly, literally called the pharmacy, asked for a pharmacist, and said, hey, I'm not affiliated with the hospital, but I'm a frontline, I'm not frontline, but I'm intubating patients on a near daily basis, and I'd like to get the vaccine. So they're like, sure, what's your phone number? Bring your badge. When we get it in, we'll let you know, but we have to give 10 doses per vial, so we need to bring 10 people in at once in order to give it. So I didn't expect to be getting it probably this early, unless something changes. But anyway, any thoughts about all my randomness about various topics?
Well, I think there's a lot of important things. Like, okay, so this whole thing with the 1 year with the vaccine, that could be scary because people are, it was rushed. But the technology that was used for an mRNA vaccine, that's 15 plus years in development. This is not something that came out of the blue. It accelerated a lot of the processes. And I think people should be taking comfort in that. You know, if you're scared of something that has 15 plus years of technology behind it, then you shouldn't be using an iPhone.
Yeah.
Right. Because an iPhone was just created in 2007. So granted, that technology was based on something else. The other part, I guess, if people are having questions about vaccinations and they have a history of having a perspective of anti-vaccines, right? Being aware enough to recognize that this is where I am coming from. That bias is going to influence any information that comes in. Mm-hmm. The question that you need to ask is, well, what do I need to know to feel safe?
Yeah.
Not how do I confirm my biases, right? Because if we're going to say, there was aborted tissue that was used 42 years ago, blah, 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 blah. Then I can guarantee you shouldn't be doing almost any medical care. Because if we go back in a historical standpoint, much of what we have done and learned is based on things that were pretty bad. I mean, you think about... there was even a movie about it. The woman whose cancer cells were stolen from her, essentially, and they developed all this research from Henrietta, the Life and Times of Henrietta. It was an African American woman.
Yes,
they took
or
her.
Even, yeah,
and they basically took this stuff without her permission and have developed an entire like ecosystem that has provided benefits to millions and millions of people. And her family got nothing out of that. It was without their permission, without anything else. That's wrong in tragedies, you know. So maybe if that's the case, then don't use any of the care methods that are devised there. So, but you're just going to be aware of what your biases are.
Yeah.
And I do think if you have a very strong bias, the first question you need to ask is, well, what information would help me to change this? Or what information do I need to know? And if you can't think of anything, then there's an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, because at a point you're not going to change. So, yeah. But well, yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of like Tuskegee, a lot of the stuff we've learned about.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it looks like Marsha Cucaro said that Henrietta my mother? Lacks.
Henrietta Lacks. There you go. The Life and Times of Henrietta Lacks, I think. I knew she would have seen it because she's seen everything.
Yeah. Well, like the Tuskegee and like the stuff we know about syphilis, like the
syphilis. Nazi war experiments by that. There's a lot of medical advancements that came out of Nazi experiments on humans, which were horrible. And there was a big debate on what to do with that, whether they should have just trashed it or use it. I mean, things on hypothermia, how long people can survive in frozen waters came from Nazi experiments, which was, I'm sure you don't want to know that, but you know, there's a lot of horrible stuff in the past, and we don't ever want to say that was the right thing to do, but I also don't want to, we don't lose that technology. You know, the other thing, like a lot of the technology has come from wartime. Like we've learned all the stuff from wars. Like, we're not going to say we glorify our wars, but we're not going to lose that technology that we advance. Penicillin came in the middle of World War II, if I'm remembering correctly. So yeah, anyway, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting when you said, well, you know, you don't use the iPhone if we just invent it. And then they're going to be like, well, it's not, the iPhone's not injected into me. I'm like, okay, genetic material, we get exposed to genetic material in various ways. If you have sex with somebody, you're going to get exposed to genetic material. So let's just like, come on, people. Just let's have
There was a really great analogy for, I mean, I'm going to butcher this because I can't remember it, that had to do with an mRNA vaccination, which is completely different technology than a lot of the past vaccinations. And by the way, this is super exciting stuff because this mRNA technology has so many applications outside of the COVID, and because it didn't start that way, right? There's cancer applications. This could be like game changing when it comes to a lot of diseases. This technology is like amazing. But I forgot where I was going with that. What was I saying?
I was actually just looking up something to share. So you're going to have to.
Yeah, I don't remember where I was going with that. It's something with the mRNA vaccination.
Oh, the things that were like cancer and whether it's.
Yeah, there was all. Stuff. There has all these other things that you can utilize it for. So it's like totally game changing. Oh, I don't remember. Maybe it had something to do with the iPhone. I don't know.
So I have to mention this because you can extract. You know, certain ingredients that are in things and like, that's just like horrible and all that. So propofol we use in like 99% of people to get to sleep, like 95%, you know, plus, you know, and it's mixed in a liquid, it contains soybean oil and a substance called egg lecithin. So, you know, like that comes from an animal and, you know, it's okay. It doesn't mean it's, you know, a fertilized egg. I'm just saying like, it's just there's components that are used from the world we live in.
Yeah, if you're a vegan, you shouldn't get propofol. If you're a vegan,
that's right. You're getting injected with some egg.
Yeah.
So, but the funny thing is, like a lot of times people are actually, if they have an allergy, like an egg allergy, a lot of times it's not the lecithin portion of it, so they're fine with it. So, don't freak out. It's actually, if I was gonna have anesthesia for a short procedure. Hands down, I'd rather not have sevoflurane or other gas anesthesia. I'd rather have propofol. As long as I have someone who can manage the airway in case I obstruct, which I can do under general anesthesia with propofol. So anyway, we're off on a different topic, but there are so many components that we utilize from the earth to help create a life or things that we do for each other. So
here's the other thing about safety. Right. So people have concerns about the safety of a vaccine. Well, we don't know what the long-term effects are. Well, we know what the effects of the COVID infection are. This is not the flu. This is significantly more dangerous. If you still think it's the flu, you're not following the data. People say, well, you're young and healthy. It's no big deal. Well, no, it looks like it's causing these vascular, it's not just infecting your lung systems. It seems like it has this vascular effect where it's inflammatory vasculitis kind of a thing. Yeah, that's where the young people are having strokes. And the other way to think about it is the stress that you're putting your body under. You're 20 years old. You're going to hit with the COVID infection. You're hitting with like 10 to 20 years of stress that you are now subjecting it to.
Yeah.
If you think, you know, you want to age 10 to 20 years, just normally, like if you're 20 years old, most people would say, "Oh, I don't want to do that." Well, why would you subject your health and your body to that kind of stress from a disease that's just going to, sure, you're going to recover, You have great internal resiliency when you're younger, but it's going to pound you, man. And it's like, yeah. Why put your body through that much stress with long-term implications that we have no idea about, when we can use a vaccine that has 15 plus years of technology behind it? The technology itself doesn't get incorporated into your DNA. You know, there was an analogy about a sandwich. Like, you know, the way that this works is sort of like a sandwich, but you know, it's not like you eat the peanut butter sandwich and then all of a sudden you're some peanut butter monster hybrid thing, you know, something like, such a great explanation.
Yeah.
But that's like, you know, this technology isn't going to create a peanut butter hybrid monster person. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. You made me think of there was a couple things I wanted to say off of your last comment. I was asked, because I take my precautions. I wear like a double mask kind of thing, N95 with a surgical over it to keep it, you know, in case it gets soiled or whatever. And I take my precaution. And somebody, I was just talking about my, like when I go and have like 5 minutes to go eat a shake, or, you know, I rarely eat during the day when I'm working because I'm in the operating room the whole time. But if I have 5 minutes, I step outside and I take off my mask and I don't sit in the lounge with other people eating. Like, that just doesn't make common sense to me. I mean, I know they do, and that's, yeah, everyone's got their prerogative. I just feel more comfortable out there. And someone asked me if I was scared. I'm like, no, like I'm not shivering in fear when I put my seatbelt on. Like, I'm just taking precautions and just like anybody else. And the secondly, what I tell people is like, I know there's stuff going around. I just don't want to be sick, period. Like, whether it's COVID or not, do you really want to just be like, yeah, I want to be off for 2 weeks and not make any money if I don't have any sick leave? And, you know, sure, no problem. I just want to be sick. Just get it over with. Like, no, I'd rather not be sick. Period. End of story. And then I had to mention an update from someone. I worked in Evansville, Indiana, which is at the southernmost tip of Indiana, for probably 8 weeks worth of work this past year. And one of the anesthesiologists, I was like, hey, how's it going up there? You know, he's like, oh, it's like a hot spot. And I was like, yeah, I don't know what it is about. And it's not really just the Midwest, but he's in the area. I was just like, I don't know what it is about Midwest. Can't believe in anything that's invisible, like a virus. And he's like, yeah, everyone's wearing it over their mouth. Their nose is sticking out. And it's like, yeah. What's the point?
Like, this drives me insane. It's like,
I'm like, how do you not know, unless you have a numb nose, you've had some, you know, flap transfer, you can't feel it. How do you not know it's not over your nose? You know, I know it may not
be on purpose. They'll pull it down, you know, because they can't breathe. It's like, or whatever they're saying. It's
not occlusive. It's not an occlusive mass. It's not putting negative pressure on you breathing. Just is laying on you.
Yeah. People are crazy. And the other thing about that, so I'm thinking about your break room. Well, why aren't you eating the break room? Well, if people started visualizing air like water, because that's what it is. It's water that's not as dense.
It's vapored. Right?
Because water is very dense, but we still live in an ocean of air. And why would you put yourself where you take your mask off in a closed environment where there's crap sitting all over the place? I mean, it could be COVID, it could be flu. That makes me think of, because one of the things is in one of the physician groups, physician groups, and people are talking about this stuff. One of the pros about all this crap for COVID is there's so many people saying, oh, I didn't catch the flu this year. I haven't been sick since I've started, you know, wearing masks and seeing all my patients. And there's so many of them are like, yeah, they're like, I'm not going to stop this. And this is great. Like pediatricians, how they're so happy they're not getting colds every 2 weeks and stuff. I'm like, this is just cracking me up.
Mm-hmm. Well, now maybe they won't do the targeting that they do, you know, just because you're wearing a mask, thinking the suspicious behavior. And like, you know, if they want to racially target somebody just because they're wearing something over their nose and the mouth and they must be up to something. It's like now everybody's like wearing a mask. So our brains are used to seeing it versus thinking there's something suspicious.
Well, hopefully we're like the Asian countries, right? Mm-hmm. It's normal. It's completely, they wore masks and they did it for infection control. But actually, like when we went to Japan, I was reading up on all a little bit, is people just even wear masks if they just feel uncomfortable. Like maybe they have a zit or something, they'll wear a mask. It's not a big deal. And I would like to see that here. I would also like to see that we never shake hands again, because that's nasty. And I think, you know, there's some good
hug
public
the ones you love.
Yeah. I'll hug my loved ones, but man, I don't want to shake some weirdo's hand. Who knows? Particularly you go in the bathroom, right? And you watch all these people walk out without washing their hands. It's disgusting. Yeah. Like, why? Yeah.
Ugh. At the very, I mean, I think fist bumps, you know, that's
elbow bumps.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you know, it might be a little more commonplace. Well, you know, we've gone an hour.
No, I was going to say, we got to cut this off.
Yeah, we got to cut this off. Anyway, you want to take us out, Kevin?
Sure. Although I think, you took us in. Anyway,
I would just say,
this is the Change Physician Podcast. This is our live stream for December 24th, Christmas Eve of 2020. Thank you for joining us today. We have some fantastic episodes coming up, and we do have a live show, our new live stream, which will be on New Year's Eve. So join us for the Change Physician New Year's Eve live stream a week from today. Hope you have a wonderful and safe holiday seasons. Please see your families via Zoom, not in person. Get through the year. Stay safe, stay sane, and until next time, stay well, folks.
Bye. Thank you for joining us today on the Change Physician Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please let us know by going to thechangephysician.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the free book giveaways, guides, and other physician resources available to you simply by joining the community at thechangephysician.com.